It's really a pleasure to be here. I have an overly complicated handout. If you picked up the handout, it's overly complicated. But really, I have five main points that I would like to share with you, even though there are six on my handout. That's from incomplete editing. The first point that I want to make is what we might call the cover story of modernity. That'll be my first point, the cover story of modernity. My second point will be the reasonableness of believing. My third will be religion as a special case of believing. And then my final points will have to do with belief and plausibility and the problems around that. So I realize I just enumerated 4 points for you. Well, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. So let me begin then. The first point has to do with the cover story of modernity. And the backdrop to this, in a way, is the appreciation of the fact that medieval culture is a tradition reverencing culture. And intellectual discussion in medieval culture was really largely around the parameters of received authorities. In fact, in scholastic theology, to establish the existence of a question, a topic for discussion, it was sufficient to demonstrate that you had at least two authorities on either side of the question. So the project of the intellectual project of that culture, in some sense, was began with an acknowledgement of its received authorities and an effort to kind of show how they could be coherent or how it could all fit together into some kind of coherent whole. And modernity really begins in a kind of open-eyed break from that sort of thing. Modernity begins with, there's lots of different strands of modernity. This isn't my original thesis. This is sort of Strauss's thesis in a way. There are several different strands of modernity, but what sort of unifies them is that all of them understand themselves rather self-consciously as making a break with the medieval past, a break with this kind of culture of authority, a culture of belief, in as much as the acceptance of authorities involves you in believing. And so one way of thinking about this that might be suggestive builds off a little essay of Strauss's called The Three Waves of Modernity. It's a short little essay, but The Three Waves of Modernity by Strauss. He has a way of talking about the turn in modernity to what we might call a sort of utilitarian individualism. This is sort of the kind of what's in it for me, getting and spending dimension of our culture, and it winds its way through. But you also have a little bit of a pushback against that, so you get this sort of romantic, expressive side of the thing. And the romantic, expressive side of the thing is really sort of taking refuge in feelings and the deepness of our feelings as over against the tawdriness of the daily drill of getting and spending and so on and so forth. And then there, the most recent sort of iteration on the theme is a kind of reaction against all of this, which is a sort of relativistic nihilism or something like that that sort of takes root, where it becomes impossible in this whole kind of discourse of modernity and then the postmodern reaction to it, it becomes impossible to really articulate rational grounds for preferring one way of life or another. It really just comes down to the authority of the individual in the sense of making some kind of more or less completely arbitrary, for all we know, decision about what's important to me, what I care about, who I am, what my identity is, and so on and so forth. These are all just completely personal decisions that can't be, that are not, in a certain sense, subject to any kind of objective criteria for adjudication as to their adequacy. And so part of the thing to realize, to recognize in this, is this kind of this consistent strand of individualism, so that all the authority all along the line really is just vested in the individual. It's kind of imagined as somehow atomic and isolated. That's not incompatible with all kinds of language about how special community is and how important it is and so on and so forth. But ultimately, fundamentally, there's this kind of recourse to, you know, the individual autonomy as the foundation for take and receive, for any sort of claim to value. Along with this kind of turn, we see another aspect that seems striking to me, and this is just a sort of a hunch, but pre-modern scholastic thought, medieval thought, it seems to me, does not really have an epistemology. That is to say, it does not really have a philosophical project of trying to validate our knowledge of the external world. It has an account of knowledge. The medievals are interested, they have an account of knowledge, but they're not anxious about it. They're not in the defensive crouch about how do we know objective reality. The defensive crouch comes from the moderns, who get to be extremely anxious about it because of their open-eyed break with this kind of, with the idea that it's safe to believe. And so the epitome of this, in some sense, is Descartes' idea that the way you can found a philosophy is by a strategy of methodic doubt. Just doubt everything and try and build it all back up from the ground. You see lots of different variations on this, Carnap's relaxation and so forth. But so this becomes a kind of a, this is sort of the, in, it seems to me in some ways a characteristically modern move in philosophy, is to become very, very preoccupied with the problem of knowledge of the objective world as its basic problem, whereas the central problem in medieval thought is not that problem. The central problem, the first philosophical topic, is the structure of being, its ontology or metaphysics. Now, notice the presupposition that they're making. It's possible to do that kind of a science. It's possible. For the medievals, it's taken for granted in some way that it's possible to articulate kind of a basic semantics or a basic stance on how reality is objectively and independently of ourselves. And for the moderns, this becomes extremely problematic to the point in the culture that we're living in. Educated persons, part of their education is to be socialized into being deeply suspicious about this kind of thing. Anybody who comes in and has some grand narrative is selling something. The grand narrative is always a cover story. Well, here I am with a grand narrative about the cover story that tells you that grand narratives are always cover stories. I think that's kind of a cover story. Part of the fruit of that cover story is sort of this idea that we get culturally, we sort of have it with mother's milk, you know, that there's science, which is about knowing, and there's religion, which is about believing. And religion is the realm, and belief is the realm of receding darkness, and science and knowing is the realm of expanding light. And so you more or less have to take your side. You can either be one of the bad people that are for religion and believing, or one of the good people who stands for science and the expansion of the light. And part of what makes this a cover story, which I'll talk about presently, is that, of course, modern science is a structure of believing, largely, and I'll talk about what I mean by that in a minute. It's also a tradition. Modernity is a tradition, and it's a tradition whose founding conceit is the notion that we're not a tradition. So you have this tradition of modernity that is the tradition of insisting it's not a tradition. And there's a lot of ways to get at this problem, but there's a lot of sophisticated variations, so I don't want to just pretend that it's all really a simple thing. But I think culturally we're familiar with what comes down to us, and we're familiar with the environment that we live in. And I don't think it's a stretch to say you can recognize some of the things that I'm talking about, the profound difficulty of making any kind of moral argument that isn't ultimately rooted in just some kind of an arbitrary respect for individual preferences and so forth, and a relative rootlessness in terms of our, in terms of our relation, the problematic relation we have to our own history, the history of our culture, and so forth, and the claims that it makes upon us. And I would just, by way of a coda to this section, I would just submit, there are reasons to be very concerned about this. Even if you're not a person who's just against it, if ultimately there aren't any criteria besides my preference and your preference, then we're kind of stuck in terms of our ability to have a conversation about the right way to live together, the right way to order our communities together, and so forth. There really isn't a way for the thing to make progress except in terms of winners and losers by the exercise of power. Who has power? And so it all becomes about power politics, which I know there's nothing like that in the modern university, but it could happen. So I think there's reasons for a person to be, kind of deeply concerned about the loss of an articulable set of criteria for making value judgments, moral judgments, and deliberating together. It seems to me the inevitable breakdown of reasoned conversation that must sort of follow that, because there are no criteria for sort of moving forward, for getting some stakes in the ground and saying, well, at least we can all agree upon this. So, okay, that's my first section. And let me just pause for one brief moment and say, I made a number of irresponsibly brash assertions there. Are there any brief questions just for clarification about what I said there? In particular, is it clear what I mean when I say the difference between the medievals having an account of knowing, but not being concerned about epistemology? Is that point sort of clear? Because that seems to me to be inherently maybe vague to you, likely to be inherently vague. Yes, sir?
I was just wondering if you could say a little more about what you mean by modernity.
Oh, jeez.
I have a similar question.
Yeah.
The medievals with the moderns in terms of
right.
The medievals being more concerned with the structure of being and the moderns being more cornered and how the heck can we know anything.
Right.
But the two, in one way, in certain ways, in certain moderns in terms of
yes.
being cornered are still getting their way out of that, are getting their way out of that in terms of the structure of being.
Yeah, that's right.
So I was hoping you could say a little bit more about that, which might
Yeah, those are both good questions. Well, modernity means a lot of things, and so I wouldn't sort of venture a definition. But you have a broad movement of thought and culture that begins with a more or less explicit repudiation of the way things have been done, say, up to prior to Machiavelli or whatever. So you begin to get a critique of the presuppositions of that whole kind of scholastic discourse and the projects of an earlier tradition, its engagement with classical authors and so forth. You know, Bacon with his remark, Francis Bacon with his remark that the politics of Aristotle are like the stars. They're very high, but they're so high they give no light. And so then the real question becomes not how do you order, how do you orient yourself with respect to the true and the just and so on and so forth, which is sort of the classical problem. It really just becomes how do you get things done? If the king will tell me what he wants to achieve, I will help him figure out the way to achieve it. So it's something like that kind of a turn. It's true that you do get metaphysical. It's true that you do get metaphysical projects in modernity. So really, in a way, the point that I mainly wish to make there is a point about the confident presupposition versus the problematized situation in modernity, and epistemology as the branch of philosophy that is it's really concerned about the justification it's not just concerned with a statement of how we know. It's concerned with a defense of why that's knowing. And that's a kind of a that seems to me, that's a kind of a characteristically modern, kind of project. It's the kind of project you begin to see with Descartes and so on and so forth. And a little bit of, it seems to me, it's connected to the break with the prior assumption is that the ancients have something important to say to us. And in some way, the prior assumption is that the ancients in some relevant way, actually were wiser than we. And we should listen to it and figure out what their wisdom was. And modernity is the supposition that it almost becomes the self-evident presupposition that, well, we must know more than the ancients because look at how advanced we are relative to they. And there's a kind of a thesis of progress that is not only has there been tremendous change between our time and Plato's, but it's more or less, despite some disquieting episodes, been the run of sweetness and light. And so here we are, knowing so much more than they. It's a broad thing, and I think there's a lot of reasons to want to qualify it with the death of 1,000 qualifications, or kill it with the death of 1,000 qualifications. And all teaching is oversimplifying. So here we go. My next point, then, is the reasonableness of believing. This in a way is going to seem extremely simple, but it's also a thing that's really worth getting clarity on. St. Thomas says, and I'll come back to this in a minute, because I actually don't want to start with religious believing. I want to just start with believing. But St. Thomas says the reason we accept the articles of faith is that God has revealed them, who neither deceives nor is deceived. Neither deceives nor is deceived. Now, the reason I mentioned is I want you to think about just this thing that's important. The basis for believing, he says, is your... let me just actually stop for 1 second because I skipped the step that might be important. By believing... Here's my working definition. Believing means taking somebody else's word for it. You don't know yourself, but you're taking somebody else's word for it. And the notion that you're taking God's word for it, because God neither deceives nor is deceived, it seems to me comes out at saying this: you believe someone if you have a reasonable judgment that the person is competent, that is not deceived in the matter in question, and trustworthy, not intending to deceive you in the matter of question. It's reasonable to believe a person under those conditions, and in fact, I'll suggest it's unreasonable not to. So this is extremely important. What makes it reasonable to believe is your judgment about the competence and trustworthiness of the person you're believing. If they are competent and trustworthy, it's eminently reasonable to believe them. And if they're, and then if you, of course, if you begin to suspect that they're not competent or not trustworthy, then you obviously cease believing what they tell you. Okay? So, it seems to me it would be easy to you could multiply examples about this. So the other weekend on Saturday I went into Connecticut. I drove. I never had been to the place that I was going. I got in my car and I put on Waze. And Waze, the soothing voice of Waze, told me when to turn right and when to turn left. And I arrived safely at my destination. And basically, I never doubt Waze, because Waze is the infallible oracle in matters geographic. So I've never been to this place before. I didn't even stop to look at a map before I left. I just got in my car, and I turned on Waze, and I said, here's where I'm going. As a matter of fact, I did more than that. The night before, I told Waze where I was going and asked it, what time should I leave if this is when I want to be there? And the whole thing is an exercise in believing, because I've never driven this route. I've never tested it before. I actually have no idea, an imminently generated idea, of how long it would take me to get there. I'm just all along the line completely trusting the competence and the honesty of the people who did the programming for Waze, who themselves, of course, are trusting in the competence and honesty of other persons. For instance, the people who did the GPSs and the satellites, and the people who put together the maps that are compilations of thousands of surveys. Because no one person has gone out and made all these surveys. In fact, the interstate highway itself that I drove upon was built on the basis of hundreds of different surveys and engineering studies that no one person made, but different persons were computed to do it, and on the supposition that they were competent and honest, the results were compiled and the plans drawn up and the workers dispatched and the highway built. And of course, the surveyors and the engineers who are engineering on the basis of what the surveyors delivered to them are themselves relying on all kinds of tables that they have in their engineering, well, probably not in engineering textbooks anymore. In the old days, they were in engineering textbooks. Now they're probably online somewhere. But, you know, they're looking up all kinds of different standards that they themselves aren't testing, you know, directly. They're not devising tests. They're assuming that the standards are competently ordained and so forth. So the whole thing is an enormous structure of believing. And you'd be an absolute idiot to say, well, I'm not having any of it. I'm just not going to participate in this believing business because it's irrational I'd rather find some cave and begin guessing at which berries are edible. So the point that I want you to take away is that believing is something that we do all the time. You couldn't actually have modern civilization without it. You couldn't have any civilization without it. You couldn't have modern science without it. Because no scientist goes back to the beginning of her science and reruns every experiment. They all just assume, I say just assume, they rationally assume the competence and honesty of their predecessors. And also, of course, there's an ongoing process, and if problems show up, then you go back and sort it out. Figure out what went wrong where. And occasionally it does, in a newsworthy way, turn out that somebody faked or was basically incompetent or whatever. And of course, the more difficult matters are hard to devise experiments for. So there is all of that. That's all true. But what's also true is that we're believing all the time, and it's one of the most reasonable things that we do, on the supposition that other persons are competent and honest. It doesn't mean that you're supposing that they're competent and honest about everything, but they're competent and honest in the matters in which you have reasons to suppose their competence and their honesty. That's eminently rational. We do it all the time. Okay? Now here I would introduce a brief distinction, which later I will come back to. And that is the distinction between the trust that we have in a person and the belief that we have in the things that they tell us. So we might think of the surveying results or the engineering studies that I was talking about, that we're accepting all of those and we're using them as the basis to build our hypothetical highway. And in some sense, prior to that or underneath it, underwriting it, is the trust we have in the competence and honesty of the persons who produce those studies. And, of course, that's embedded in a trust in the competence and honesty of the persons who produce their equipment that they use, their instruments, and so on and so forth. Well, you just see how the thing ramifies through everything we're doing. So I just want to make that distinction between the trust in the sense of the apprehension or relationship that regards the persons and the beliefs by which I would denote the objects, the contents. The classical distinction from Augustine, I mean, it's probably older than Augustine, is the fides quae, that is, the matters which are believed, and the fides qua, the faith by which we accept them. And something like that distinction is what I mean here. But what I want to also to illustrate is it's not only a thing that suddenly occurs when you get to religion or theology. It happens in any kind of analysis of all the believing we do as human beings, which is an extraordinary amount of believing. Now, religion, the moment you've all been waiting for. Wait, clarifications about that? It's good so far? Great, I'm going to run out of time anyway if I don't. Okay, religion. Religion is a special case of believing, but it is a case of believing. It's a special case of believing. Let me do it the other way. It's a case of believing because it's a case of taking, maybe not religion in general, but this is probably true of other religious traditions as well. Anyway, it's certainly true of Christianity. You're taking somebody's word for it, but it would be true of a tradition like Buddhism or Islam. If you're a Buddhist and you haven't attained nirvana for yourself, you're trusting the Buddha who says to you, here's the things you need to do and the attitudes you should have, and you don't know for yourself. You're just taking his word for it. And if you're a Christian, you're trusting Jesus and taking his word for it. Which is what I do. Now, so in that sense, it's a case of believing. It's a particular case of believing. It's a special case of believing. So to say we do a lot of believing and religion is another area where we're believing is not just to mush everything together into some undifferentiated mass. It is a special case of believing. We are accepting. We're taking the Lord's word for things that we acknowledge as part of our taking his word for them, as part of what we're taking his word on. We're taking his word about matters that we ourselves did not discover and could not discover, and in fact, we ourselves are not competent in these matters. We are not competent. I mean, that's the presupposition of Christian faith. You're accepting something in the express acknowledgement that this is not a matter in which I myself am competent or can become competent. I cannot become competent in this matter. Now, that doesn't make it unreasonable. We do all kinds of believing in matters in which we're not competent and we have no intention of becoming competent. And it's not the intention of becoming competent or even the possibility of becoming competent that makes it reasonable. It's the competence and honesty of the person we're believing that makes it reasonable. And so here's a case where we're taking Jesus' word for it, so to speak, on the basis of his competence and honesty. Okay, so so you have two different things going on there. One is the general structure of believing is verified here as in the other cases. Taking somebody's word for it on the basis of trusting them as competent and honest, okay, truthful. So on the one hand, that's verified, but on the other hand, it is a special case because the matters themselves are acknowledged to be matters in which it's de facto impossible. In fact, de jure impossible for us to become competent in this life, in these matters. Now the scholastics, St. Thomas, you may know, will make a distinction between among the objects that are accepted. He will distinguish the preambles of faith and the articles of faith. This is a familiar distinction, at least to some of you. By the preambles, he means actually the matters in which we are in some way competent. By the articles of faith, he means what I will call mysteries in the proper sense. Mysteries in the proper sense. So you could say most Christians are not in possession of a valid proof for the existence of God that they themselves have understood and personally verified. I think that's just the case. I mean, it's possible to get there, but it's possible also to learn calculus, and it turns out to have a lot of presuppositions, and I don't think most people get there. But nevertheless, for St. Thomas, it's a preamble in the sense that in principle, he thinks it's possible to sort that out properly, philosophically. What's not possible is to get to the knowledge that God is the Trinity, or that the eternal Word became a Jew of Galilee. Those are matters in which we are not competent. Those are things that we accept by faith in the strictest sense. We only can have them by taking somebody else's word for it. Notice that that's not irrational because it has the same rational foundation as every other kind of believing, a supposition in the competence and honesty of the person whose word we're taking. Which really means, in a certain sense, everything comes down to your reasons for trusting Jesus, which I'll come back to in a minute. Let me note some corollaries, however, first. One is, The reason these mysteries are disproportionate, when I say disproportionate, I mean to say they're de jure beyond the competence of our reason to discover or to verify, to improve upon. You can't improve upon the articles of faith, it turns out. Has something to do with the nature of our data on them. Our data on them are really data on the testimony of Jesus and the witnesses to him. They're not data directly on these matters themselves. God is not a datum of your experience in this life. And so while you can know something about God by extrapolating on what you do know, the world, you can posit that there's a cause and you can say a few things about what the cause is like. Knowledge of God as God is in himself is just beyond your capacity because God, there are no data on God. God is not the object of any of your sensitive experiences and not in an immediate way the object of any of your interior experiences either, until you get to heaven when it will be very cool. But until then, you're walking, as St. Paul says, by faith and not by sight. So that's the first corollary. It has something to do with the nature of the data. The second corollary is, because we're not competent in these matters, we have to be appropriately modest in what we think we can do with them by the light of our reason. We cannot improve upon them. I already said that. That's number one. We can't improve upon them or verify them. Okay, number two, our understanding of them cannot be the basis for our acceptance of them. Boy, if I had a dollar for every time somebody says to me, geez, you know, I could accept purgatory if only it made more sense to me. You just want to say, well, wait a minute. None of this properly makes sense to you, and that can't become the criterion on the basis of which you accept it. You're taking somebody's word for it in a matter that's beyond your competence. So in that sense, you don't get to pick and choose. Well, I believe the engineering study that gave me the results I wanted, but the engineer became incompetent when she delivered the results I didn't like. That's not actually the way that we rationally believe, eh? In rationally believing, our intrinsic understanding of the matter is not the basis for our assent. If it were, we wouldn't be believing. We would be knowing for ourselves, which is different, which is a different thing. These aren't matters in which we know for ourselves. The third corollary, I think I'm on the third corollary. Maybe I'm on the fourth, if you're counting at home. The recording will be a mess because I cannot count. I've proven that time and again. The next corollary, whatever number it is we can't have, if our understanding isn't the proper measure and criterion of these things because we're not competent in relation to them, then the only understanding we can have is a very imperfect, what theologians call analogical understanding, that we achieve by comparing the mysteries to things that we naturally know, by comparing them to each other. So, for instance, you might compare the church to a state. That's an analogy with something we naturally know, a state as in the civil polity. You might compare the church to the incarnation, then you're comparing two mysteries, saying there's an analogical similarity here. It's not the same, but it's similar. And then you also can reason about how all these things are ordered to our final destiny as human beings, which is to have God as an immediate datum of our experience. Namely, to see God face to face, to know as we are known, to have no need, as the Apocalypse says, of light from lamps or the sun, for the Lord God shall give them light, and they shall reign forever. In your light we see light, and all that goodness. Okay, so I could dilate upon that subject for a long time, but I won't because I'll run out of time. Finally, if you're following along on the outline line, I'm at 5C3. Three errors. It's in parentheses because I anticipated skipping it for want of time. So I may not be able to count, but I am able to anticipate how these things go. So I'll skip it, but I'll just draw attention to the fact that I'm skipping it in case somebody goes home hungry and says, we wanted a fish and he gave us a stone. Okay, my sixth, on the outline, my sixth and final point is the problem of plausibility, and you might add, in the as-built version, also the problem of trust. Because I was saying, as I was saying earlier, in a certain sense, the whole deal comes down to trusting somebody, taking somebody's word for it, to supposing that that person is competent and honest. And fundamentally, as Christians, we're taking Jesus' word for it. I mean, you could say we're taking God's word for it, which is true, but we're taking God's word as delivered in Jesus, so the historical access, as it were, that we have, it's a mediated access. So let's just allow me to say, for purposes of this discussion, we're taking Jesus' word for it, and the question is, why do you do that? Why should you take Jesus' word for it? And it seems to me there are a number of different kinds of problems with taking Jesus' word for it. But let me just mention two of them for the moment. One is, what do you actually know about Jesus? And the other is, I'm putting these out here to speak to them, by the way, not to leave you disturbed. And the other is, the kinds of things that are represented about Jesus are, it seems to me, they're prima facie difficult to accept. That is, if I came in here, it's not hard to do an imaginative exercise on this. When Janet, was it Napolitano? Janet Reno, do you remember Janet Reno? She just died. You probably don't remember. When I was a freshman in university, the Attorney General was Janet Reno. We called her Nero. We thought it was convenient. Her name was Reno. And the big case that happened at that time was the case of these people in Waco called the Branch Davidians, who had holed up in this compound around a guy who thought he was the Messiah. And they had all kinds of guns and stuff in there. You know how bad that is, especially in Texas. So eventually it was decided that the government should bulldoze the place, and which they did, and created a fiery inferno in which all kinds of people died, like 32 children or something. Amazingly enough, Janet Reno, she authorized this thing in the first year of her term, finished her term, and another one. But that's a side piece. She just died. This was just in the news, because she passed away a couple weeks ago. May she rest in peace. But the thing is, the object lesson is, when you think of a story like that, you immediately realize, when this guy, David Koresh, gets together his band of 50 people and they go hole up in this compound in Waco, and the guy says, I'm the Messiah, you experience yourself as not disposed to believe it. It seems to you, it's unless I'm just really mistaken about the kind of person you are. It seems to you improbable at best that he's the Messiah. And you could say kind of tritely, well, that's because Jesus is the Messiah, not David Koresh. But the question in a certain way recurs, which is, you know, a guy that walks around, you know, C.S. Lewis's liar, lunatic, or lord thing. This is familiar. Lewis has a lovely way of doing this in Mere Christianity, where he says, you know, when you read the Gospels and you contemplate about the astounding claims that are made on behalf of Jesus, you're left with a dilemma. And the dilemma is that you're not really left with a convenient option of thinking, hey, this is just a good guy. Jesus is a really good guy. Because he's walking around with pretense to being God, or God's agent at least. He says he can forgive sins. He tells people, you have to leave everything and follow me. I am the Lord of the Sabbath, by the way. And so on and so forth. And, you know, Lewis basically says it kind of boils down to either he's a tremendous liar, or he's crazy, or he is who he says he is. And there's something about this that's right. And I think Lewis, if I remember how he does his little exercise rightly, he winds up also saying, and actually liar isn't really on the table either, because it's so outrageous it would have to be completely pathological, in which case you're back to lunatic. And it seems to me something like that is right. I mean, this sort of thing is often dismissed by professional scholars as not really adequate to the complexity of our historical data on Jesus, but it seems to me that dismissal itself is involved in a serious problem, because while it may be true that what we have about Jesus as media is refracted through the tellings of the evangelists and the testimony of St. Paul and so on and so forth, one thing we know for sure: people were worshiping Jesus. That's one thing we know for sure. In fact, it's probably the earliest thing we know for sure. Probably the earliest thing we know about Christianity is they were worshiping Jesus, which means not Gentile Christians who converted later, but the original generation of Jesus' disciples who were Jews, raised on, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is your God, the Lord alone. Therefore you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength," and so forth. These people found themselves worshiping Jesus, and I'm sure they wondered why. They're wondering why becomes Trinitarian theology, but we'll come back to that in the next episode. I'm sure they wondered why, but it seems to me it's just a bedrock fact. If we know anything about Jesus, we know that he was being worshipped. And if we know anything else about him, it's because he was being worshipped. So the question is, well, how did it come to pass that this Jew of Galilee was being worshipped by other Jews as God, or alongside God, or whatever they thought they were doing? And it seems to me you're sort of in this dilemma that Lewis paints, and a question arises for you, perhaps. A question arises, and the question is this the kind of thing that God would do or not? That's maybe a funny way to put it. But this is, in some sense, how you come back to ultimately believing God. Is this the kind of thing that God would do or not? That is the universe of our experience, is it fundamentally a good place, a good, self a good, chosen out of love by someone for a purpose? Is it plausible?
Is it plausible that God, seeing our plight, should become a Jew of Galilee because he loves us and not because there's anything in it for God? Is that plausible? Or is it plausible that the universe, is it more plausible that the universe is just simply a random event with no meaning, no purpose, in fact, ultimately unintelligible? Everything else in the world has reasons. We're always asking for reasons. We don't accept things without reasons. We want to know why. Is it more plausible that the universe itself has no why? That there's no why for it? That we ourselves are concerned about value and what's worthwhile, but the universe itself is not worthwhile and not valuable and not chosen by a moral agent for a moral purpose? Which is more plausible? And if we find ourselves inclined to think what has to be more plausible is that the universe is intelligible and valuable, then you ask yourself, what's more plausible, that it's just left to its own devices? I've chased them away.
Oh, that's good.
Speaking of worthwhile.
Okay.
It seems to me, I think of this a lot of times at Easter time,
because the resurrection is one of those things that
just culturally seems so implausible. And yet, when I'm meditating upon the resurrection and upon the passion of our Lord, it just seems to me just amazingly right that this is just exactly the way God would do it. And I don't want to make a kind of a shoulda, woulda, coulda argument out of this. I actually want to point out a broader issue, which I might call the Pride and Prejudice problem. Do you know Pride and Prejudice? If you have never read Pride and Prejudice, your education is not complete. It's a great novel, but the thing that is so beautiful about it is the protagonist, Elizabeth. The short version of the thing is there's two men in her life. One she is sure is a scoundrel, and one she is sure is lovable. And every piece of evidence that comes in on either of them is interpreted according to that pre-existing template. And at a certain point, the shock to her world is the realization that it could all be construed in a wholly, wholly different way. And what opens her up is beginning to realize the lovableness of the one she thought was a scoundrel. And it's falling in love that begins to put the evidence in a whole new light for her. And I think that there's something right about this, that you can inhabit the universe in a kind of a defensive crouch, to go back to that image, as a kind of a cold and bitter place. But you can also inhabit the universe as a person suffused with love and just an instinctive realization that for all of its problems and the ugliness and tawdriness of our inhumanity to one another and so on and so forth, that the universe is good. It has a good author who means us well. And it seems to me once you're there, you're almost home free, because it's almost as if the story of the incarnation and the resurrection of our Lord and his accepting what is ours, namely suffering and the cross, so that we might receive what is his, glory and divine life. It suddenly goes from being intrinsically implausible to the most plausible tale you ever heard.
heard.
No, that's not a proof. That's not a proof. And the fact of the matter is, in these matters, we're not competent to have a proof. You have to decide who you're prepared to trust. And the deciding who you're prepared to trust is ultimately, it seems to me, going to be a function of the condition of your heart. And I think that's why St. Thomas says that beyond the wisdom that comes from book learning, from study, there's a higher and more necessary wisdom, and it's the wisdom that flows from love, from seeing with the eyes of the heart. So with St. Paul, we should pray, I just completely screwed up my rhetorical flourish. With St. Paul, we might pray, open thou the eyes of my heart. Let me end there, and I'll be happy to take questions if there are any. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
This may be too big a question. I don't know. I'm skipping.
Yeah, good.
I have always struggled with the mysteries and because of the analogous way of understanding.
Right.
If something's analogous, but we don't know exactly what way it's analogous, then I remain skeptical that I even understand what's going on. Right? We say, like, the author of the world, but that's got to be analogous too.
Yeah, that's true.
And not just in the sense that author, somebody writes a book or.
It's a great question, and I think it's a. To some extent, it's a genuine problem. That is to say. If the one reality is unknown in itself, then how do we know we have a fruitful, analogous way of thinking about it? And part of the answer is, well, it's not completely unknown. And as a matter of fact, you might start with a humble example, something like, if you're trying to solve a problem in algebra or geometry, you set up the problem and you try and lay out all the properties you know about the x that you're trying to solve for until you're able to gradually determine at least maybe some range, okay? So it's not completely dissimilar to that, just to jerk your chain, use an analogy for starters. It's not as though we don't know anything about the mysteries, because we do have some positive judgments about them, and so for example, this is would actually not to be a mystery in the strictest sense, but to take your example of thinking about God as the author, okay? Well, one of the values of doing a kind of a rigorous effort at a proof for the existence of God is that it becomes a kind of an instrument for controlling some of your statements or for getting a handle on what you mean by things. Okay, so if we say something like this, the universe as a contingent order of things and events and so on and so forth, it's not self-explanatory. It's not completely self-explanatory. That is to say, there's all kinds of occurrences inside that order that are explained in terms of other occurrences and so forth, but as a total order, it's not self-explanatory. Let me just postulate that for a moment. That's another question, but let's postulate it for a moment and say, so we have a non-self-explanatory contingent ordered universe, and then the question is there an explanation, and what would be the properties of the explanation? And you could say, well, whatever the ultimate explanation would be, it would have to be self-explanatory. Now, I don't know what that is, but at least I can say a few things about what it's not. It's not just another non-self-explanatory universe that's just displacing the problem. It's not a circle of events that's sort of a self-enclosed circle, because the problem recurs. The existence of the circle as a whole is just a brute fact. Or, is it Krauss or whatever, the universe from nothing? you know, this sort of thing where he smuggles in the, all kinds of stuff and says, I mean, if you grant me empty space and the known laws of the physical universe, which is not nothing, but if you grant me that, then I can get the universe out of a hat. Whatever. So you can work out some properties of God, at least by a kind of a remotion, by at least saying, well, it's not another body. It's not anything that needs to be explained extrinsically. It must be self-explanatory, which means it can't be composed, but it must be simple, capable of explaining itself and everything else, and so on and so forth. And, if, you know, Thomas proceeds, St. Thomas proceeds in a way like this to work out properties of God, including that God is an intelligent and voluntary agent and so forth. Now, you may or may not be happy with what he's doing, but it seems to me he is using a few things that he can put down as stakes in the ground to leverage the development of his understanding about what do I mean by God. And it's not a completely blind process, you see. It's the development of understanding using as a leverage the things that you are able, the stakes you're able to get in the ground. Now, when he gets to question 27 of the Prima Pars, he shifts over to the mystery in the strictest sense, which is which are the questions about whether God is a Trinity, which he doesn't think you could do a philosophic argument for. So up to that point, I think he thinks he understands himself to be making claims that there's a certain competence of natural reason. But in question 27, he says, are there processions in God? And he just says, here's a hypothesis. Here's a hypothesis that may be relevant. Well, what are the criteria for its relevance? Well, does it explain what we affirm in Revelation, that there are three in God but not three gods? That in the three in God, there's a Word who's from the Father, who's called Word and Son and Image. That there's another, there's a third who's from the Father and the Son, who's called Holy Spirit, Gift, Love. Can I explain by way of my analogy the order? Can I say something about how there can be three but not three gods? Can I explain the meaning of the names that are vouchsafed to us? Why is this one Son and Word and Image? Why is this one Love, Spirit, Love, and Gift? Thank you. Boy, these are evidences of getting old. So he has some points of reference that fix at least something of what he's trying to understand. So the understanding that he arrives at, it's not a proof that God is a Trinity. It doesn't make it any more or less plausible that God is a Trinity in se, in itself. But it's an important exercise for us, because things that we don't understand at all, we find it harder to accept those things. So if you don't do the exercise of trying to get some light on it, however imperfect, you can quickly find that your faith itself may begin to break down. And it's not, it seems to me, it's not because the hypothetical understanding in theology is adding to the intrinsic plausibility, but it's adding to the plausibility in relation to us and our thought structures, you might say. And it could be fruitful in lots of other ways, because it could illumine other aspects of the thing. Why, for instance, if there are three persons in God and only one became a human being, why was it the Word? Why was that fitting? If there are three and one is given the love of God poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, Romans 5:5, Augustine's favorite verse, why the Spirit? You know, that those kinds of questions. You can do something with that. And it's not arbitrary or random or uncontrolled, even though it's imperfect. Let me give you one last thing. I know I have this train leaves the station thing. But as long as the train has left the station, the natural sciences, they operate by a weird version of you could say that the way a hypothesis and verification works in the natural sciences is it's logically dissatisfying. Why? Because your normal modus ponens, your normal syllogism, let's say, normal, whatever, but is, you know, if A, so if A, then B, but A, therefore B, okay? So, but we don't actually have that. We have if A, which is some hypothesis, then B, which is some predicted testable implication. And then what we have is there but B, therefore probably A. That's the best you can do. You see what I'm saying there? I didn't say it very clearly. If it's an important point, I'll put it up on the board. But the point is the natural sciences as hypothetical constructs, they actually never can exclude the possibility of some better and more satisfactory hypothesis. But they could explain the range of testable implications we've got. What you could exclude is the possibility of some hypothesis that doesn't explain that. If it didn't explain that, it wouldn't be entertainable even for a moment. So you have the possibility of progress, of a revision of hypothesis, of hypotheses, even of a revision of what your fundamental concepts are in say, you know, chemistry or whatever. But anyway, that's not a completely alien kind of problem to what's happening in theological understanding. Okay, thank you. I got the thumbs up. We've arrived at the next station, Westerly. Questions, comments, clarifications? Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
I had some professors who were really, just a lot of emphasis on textual criticism.
Right.
And so.
You had the Mary Magdalene experience. Yeah. They've taken my Lord, and I know not where they've laid him.
Yep. And so in those situations, I think, my faith was challenged because,
right.
It's I believe, but also I don't. I mean, by taking these classes, the competence of, the,
right.
you know, the transmission of the word and also
right.
the honesty of the people who are writing it down, that's something that is less easy to believe than Jesus. And I think that's a hang-up that a lot of people have is like, oh, man, like,
right.
I could go for God, but I'm not sure about the Bible as,
right.
you know, taking it. For its word.
Right.
Can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, well, yes, I can say a few things about it. I mean, it doesn't fall out of the sky, right? So you have other witnesses between you and Jesus, and you just can't get out of that. On the other hand, we have, within some reasonably controlled range, we're fairly clear what they said about Jesus. Maybe not what they meant, okay, but just to distinguish some questions, right? So, you know, there are problems, but there are not so many problems establishing the text of the New Testament that we have no idea what St. Paul ever wrote. I mean, there may be questions about this or that, but, okay, and similarly, there may be problems, but we're generally pretty sure. We're reasonably confident in the approximate dating strata of our material. So, so for one thing, we know that the stuff that's in the New Testament is pretty much the earliest stuff we got to go on. And then within the New Testament, Paul and various things are probably earlier than some other things. Even if that's not true, it doesn't matter, but let's suppose. So then the next question is, well, what did they mean? And so granted we know what they said, and granted we know that they more or less said it first. In other words, rival versions of the story of Jesus, like the Gnostics would tell or whatever. They're basically later stuff, right? That's not the telling of the people who actually had a living memory of Jesus or are linked to a living memory of Jesus. Now, let me just take two or three or four points that really just from Paul, but there's other ways you could do this, okay? One thing that seems clear from Paul is that we have these sort of poetic fragments, like the hymn in Philippians, though he was in the form of God, Jesus did not deem equality with God something to be grasped at, or the one in Colossians, the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creatures, and so on and so forth. Or the thing in Romans where he does the, for us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we to him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and we through him. So, in other words, you have these kinds of stylized fragments where you have the impression he's quoting something, and even if he's not, what comes clear out of them is, God, these people are having some kind of Jesus worship. That seems to me to be actually our earliest establishable fact. There was Jesus worship. I mean, whatever you make of it, okay, there was Jesus worship. That was Pliny's take on it, right? These nut jobs. I don't know what they're about, but they're worshiping this guy. So then you could ask the question, I mean, granted all the problems, and granted, okay, maybe I don't trust Paul. So you don't have to trust Paul for this exercise. All you have to know from Paul is that Paul provides you evidence that there was Jesus worship. And then you can ask yourself the question, how do you get from the crucifixion of a guy between common thieves to Jesus worship? Like, what's the nexus there? What are the plausible nexuses, that you anglicize the thing because we can't handle those. What are the plausible nexuses between the death of Jesus and the worship of Jesus, right? There's no historical problem about Jesus dying. There may be historical problems about Jesus rising. But then you ask yourself, first of all, on the one side, well, what are the plausible, like, is it plausible that within a generation of this guy succeeding in getting himself arrested and killed, people started worshiping him, despite the fact that he never said anything like that in his whole life? Is that more plausible than the alternative? Is it more plausible to say, geez, Jesus went around being an itinerant cynic sage in a place where we don't have cynic sages, but never said anything that would give anybody the impression that he might be the Messiah, and yet he was arrested for pretending to be the Messiah? Okay, so you have a hypothesis about Jesus that doesn't explain the signal facts, that he got arrested, that he got killed, that he got worshipped, which are pretty weird facts. And just take Paul as a fact, whether you believe Paul or not, Paul is a fact. Somebody sat down and wrote this literature. Why did he sit down and write this literature? Like, why did he write it this way? I mean, even if you don't believe the claims that he himself wants to make about Jesus, you have a tremendous question about Jesus. Like, who the heck was this guy that by getting himself killed, inspired the devotion of worship and this kind of literature? St. Paul is saying, geez, well, anyway. You see the exercise, man. You see the exercise. So it seems to me there's a way in which I'm not saying it's irrelevant whether you believe the authors of the New Testament, like in other words, whether you trust them. I'm not saying that's irrelevant. Because it's not. But it seems to me that the alternative, either you trust them, or you don't know anything about Jesus, is just a lot of bunk. Even if you don't trust them, their evidence on Jesus, and the evidence is people were worshiping Jesus, which is the weirdest damn thing you ever heard of. And they were writing this kind of literature about Jesus. And a historian, not to say a believer, has to really wonder, geez, how do you get from A to B on this? From Jesus' life, why does he get arrested? You have to ask why he gets arrested. If he doesn't claim to be the Messiah, why does he get arrested? If he doesn't go around acting like he's the Messiah, and if he didn't in some way imply something that was perceived as blasphemous, why do all our sources... Anyway, I'm
flogging the dead horse because it's not dead enough.
Anyway, sorry. Okay. Is that helpful? Other questions, comments, clarifications, objections, resentments, psychological baggage, sins you'd like to propose for our edification? Yes, sir.
So, doctor, I know you put in
I did.
It seems like with natural faith, we can, as you said, we can always know it from a reliable source of knowledge. We can always become competent. Can we become competent to know that the person who's giving us this testimony, obviously the ideal here is Christ, is a person to be trusted, which would mean that we would have to know that Jesus is God. It seems like it requires us to be able to know, not to believe, but to know that Jesus is God. Otherwise, we kind of keep going into...
Yeah. No,
I bring this up because otherwise we run into the fideistic leap of faith almost, where we make the jump to say that, okay, Jesus is God, and then everything else follows, okay, we're fine. But it seems necessary that we need to know that Jesus is God, because only God would be a competent authority for which to trust.
Yeah. I think, honestly, how do I want to put this? I don't think that we know that.
Okay.
Yeah. I think ultimately we're trusting that. But here's the thing. It's not an irrational trust. That's part of the point that I want to make. We have a lot of reasons to suppose that Jesus is competent and trustworthy. And it's a little bit like, you know, what would you say about your mother? You know, Augustine has this thing where he talks about, you know, knowing who his parents are. How do I know who my parents are? Well, because my parents told me. Well, I think you have a lot of good reasons to believe your mother. And there's a lot of corroborating evidence. But none of it adds up to imminently generated knowledge. You don't have imminently generated knowledge about that. Somebody might. The attending physician.
Let's just say, in principle, you can get back to it.
Yeah, but you're still believing. You yourself, about your parents, are still believing. That's true. There is a competent witness, right? The attending physician who was there, your father, if he was there in the room, they know who your mother was. You yourself were checked out. You don't know. And you cannot go back in time. So there is ultimately a very supremely rational act of trust that's involved there. Now, I do think that the foundation of the thing is the act of trust. In other words, if the alternative were true,
Well, the alternative would be a kind of rationalism or semi-rationalism. The alternative would mean, apologetically, you could argue, you could have a valid argument that would argue somebody into the position where they would have to assent to divine revelation. I don't know that that's true. Apart from, in other words, the kind of instinct of the heart. But I don't think that that's irrational, because I think actually we do that all the time. There's all kinds of matters, our parents, that we haven't any reason to doubt them, none. Most, and all kinds of other matters, like my little example of driving to wherever that place in Connecticut was that I drove to. Can't even remember its name. Fairfield. Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, I would say there's a certain sense, there's a meaning of the word know in which you could say that you know that. But it's not the knowing that you could cast into a syllogism, adequately, or that could be adequately objectified. It's the knowing of the preponderance of evidence that Cardinal Newman talks about in The Grammar of Assent. It's the knowing that just comes out of the realization everything lines up this way. Whereas if I do it some other way, I just have all these unresolved problems in my data set, so to speak. And its evidence is too various, too numerous to give a proper enumeration to, and maybe if you did, it still doesn't add up exactly to a kind of arithmetic case. I think something like that is true. I mean, that's why we have to say, open the eyes of my heart. Unless you believe, you will never understand. And the other point that I would want to make is, I think it's just a part of the cover story to imagine that that makes it somehow irrational or arbitrary. It's not irrational or arbitrary. It's not irrational or arbitrary for you to accept who your mother is, your birth mother, or whatever. I don't know if that's... Your face doesn't feel like you're satisfied. Yeah. Don't look. Nope, yeah. So I'll think some more about how I want to put that too, because it's a good question, and I have the feeling that I should have made a better account of it. So thank you. I think I'm out of time. So the hook has come. Thank you very much. You're wonderful.